On June 2nd, 2008, George Bush, President of the United States, awarded a medal to the family of Private First Class Ross A. McGinnis of the United States Army. Here is what his decoration reads. For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life, above and beyond the call of duty, Private First Class Ross A. McGinnis distinguished himself by acts of gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty while serving as an M2 50 caliber machine gunner, 1st Platoon C Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Infantry Regiment, in connection with combat operations against an armed enemy in Adhamiya, Northeast Baghdad, Iraq, on 4 December 2006. That afternoon, his platoon was conducting combat control operations in an effort to reduce and control sectarian violence in the area. While Private McGinnis was manning the 50 caliber machine gun, a fragmentation grenade thrown by an insurgent fell through the gunner's hatch into the vehicle. Reacting quickly, he yelled, "Grenade!" allowing all four members of his crew to prepare for the grenade's blast. Then, rather than leaping from the gunner's hatch to safety, Private McGinnis made the courageous decision to protect his crew. In a selfless act of bravery in which he was mortally wounded, Private McGinnis covered the live grenade, pinning it between his body and the vehicle and absorbing most of the explosion. Private McGinnis's gallant action directly saved four men from certain serious injury or death. Private First Class McGinnis's extraordinary heroism and selflessness at the cost of his own life above and beyond the call of duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of the military service and reflect great credit upon himself, his unit, and the United States Army. He was in a position to be able to jump out of the vehicle and to save his own life. He did exactly the opposite. He gave his life that four others might live. When we look at the passage that we are going to consider this day, Jesus did not shrink back from what was facing him, which was certain death, as he would die on behalf of the whole human race. Yet he had a fearless disciple who had said that he would die for Christ. And what did Peter do? On three occasions, he shrank back. He jumped out of the hatch. He got out of the way. And yet, his Savior, only minutes before, had made note that not one of his 11 was lost. And he was talking about their physical life as an illustration of the promise he had made before, or the observation that he had made before, that all of the believers would live forever. None of them would perish. When we think about it, what would have happened if the 11 had perished? What would have happened if the 11 had been taken prisoner by the authorities and put up on crosses along with Jesus? How would the ministry have gone forth from that day? What was plan B? How are they going to come up with a plan B if those that Jesus had designated that were going to take over for him in his earthly ministry were put out of commission. And when we think about it, what had Peter done that very evening? He cut off the ear of the high priest's slave's, right ear. Now, if that isn't a way to make sure that you either get a spear thrust through you or you get arrested at least, and yet Peter was free. What Jesus had said, that not one of his men, the 11, would perish. Jesus selflessly gave his life. He courageously faced what he knew was before him, as unpleasant as it was. And amazingly, 50 days later, Peter stood up and delivered the message in the temple on Pentecost that opened up the church age. Jesus Christ needed to transform his disciples that they would be ready for the task that was before them. But in this passage, we see a stark contrast between Jesus, who was fully prepared for what it was that was before him, and his disciples, who yet had much to learn. Let us consider our passage today. We will be doing John chapter 18, verses 12 through 27. This would be a passage where, if I wanted to get into background material, we could have so much technical detail to cover that we wouldn't get to the passage at all. So I'm going to minimize the amount of technical content. There are a lot of issues with regard to the relationship between this passage and the synoptic accounts. But we will deal with some of the technicalities that surface directly from the passage itself. We start with the first section, verses 12 through 14, where Jesus is before Annas. And what we have in verse 12 is that the officials and soldiers arrested and bound Jesus. Verse 12. Then the detachment of soldiers, the captain and the Jewish temple police, arrested Jesus and tied him up. They tied him up. Notice it doesn't say they tied them up and arrested them. It's just Jesus. He has protected his disciples miraculously. Despite all odds, Jesus is the only one that is taken away that night. And yet, why was it that they made sure to bring many soldiers with weapons, lamps, and torches, as we were told in the previous passage? They expected that Jesus and his disciples would either flee, and they would have to go find them in the middle of the night, or they would put up a fight. And neither one happened. Jesus went out and he met those who were coming to arrest him, and he asked them, "Who is it that you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And at that point, they all were rocked back on their heels. They all fell to the ground. We're not told exactly why it is, but it would seem, since it was not only the Jewish officials, the Jewish temple police, but it was also the Romans who fell back, that Jesus gave them a little glimpse of his glory. And yet they dusted themselves off, and Jesus asked them, "Who is it that you seek?" And what did they say? "Jesus the Nazarene." And they proceeded to try to arrest him. Isn't that odd? Here they have seen Jesus' glory, and they go through on plan A. Let's arrest him. But interestingly enough, they only arrested him. Now in verse 13, they first took him to Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was then high priest. They first led him away to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Please observe the word first. John is the only gospel that makes mention of the appearance before Annas, but this is in a sense a preliminary examination, and John makes note of that, but then there will be a follow-up in front of Caiaphas. And John indicates that there were both of these. John is the only one who mentions this meeting that happens before Annas. But drop down to verse 24. At the conclusion of the interrogation by Annas, Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. So he gives indication that both occurred, although the one that John details for us is the meeting in front of Annas. Now, there are a couple of technical issues here in verse 13 that we do need to deal with. How is it that Caiaphas is called the high priest here, but verse 23 identifies Annas as the high priest? Notice how verse 13 ends up saying that Caiaphas was high priest that year. But then if you drop down to verse 23, where he's in front of Annas, then it says, is that any way to answer the high priest? And then verse 24 says, Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. So how is it that there are two high priests? Okay, I'm glad you asked. That was a good question. Maybe we'll move on to the next problem. Okay, no, actually, there is a simple answer here. Annas held the position of high priest from A.D. 6 until A.D. 15, when Valerius Gratus deposed him. In other words, the Romans said, we don't like you as high priest, you're no longer high priest, and so from then on it was his sons that served as high priest and one son-in-law. So he had five sons and a son-in-law. During Annas' life, he never resumed the exact role that the Romans would never have said that he was high priest after A.D. 15. But he was the power behind his sons and his son-in-law. Now, so in turn, each of his five sons and his son-in-law served as high priest in his place. Now, if I were to meet George Bush, if I had that privilege, and I were trying to think, how would I address him? Would I say, George? No. I would very likely say, Mr. President. Having been president, he rightly receives that honor of that title, although he no longer serves in the office. But there's another reason that John may be calling him high priest. The Old Testament said that a high priest served until his death. So I would take it that God may recognize him as the high priest, even though the Romans did not regard him as high priest. In all probability, the Jewish people called him the high priest and regarded him as the legitimate high priest, even though he no longer officially had that role. There had been much political intrigue that had happened ever since the time of the Hasmoneans during the intertestamental period, when people would buy and sell the position of high priest and so on and so forth. So there were a lot of things that changed from the Old Testament regulations on it. But I think that he is properly regarded as high priest, and yet at the same time, Caiaphas officially was high priest, so it is appropriate to call him high priest as well. Now, there's another interesting thing here that you notice. It says Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. And a lot of people have struggled over this, saying, well, wait a moment. You mean high priests were elected every year? No. Well, if I were to say that President Kennedy was president the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis, am I saying that he only served for 1 year? No. What is said here by John is, in this year, who was high priest? Caiaphas. It's not saying it was the only year that he was high priest, and a lot of people have gotten sidetracked on this. It says nothing about the length of term of service, does it? It just says, at this particular moment in history, who's high priest? Caiaphas. In verse 14, Caiaphas is who said, it is expedient that one man should die for the people. Clearly, Jesus is not going before an impartial judge. Let's look at verse 14. Now it was Caiaphas who had advised the Judeans that it was advantageous that one man should die for the people. Now where we find this is back in John chapter 11. So this is earlier the same year that Jesus is crucified. Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead. And there is a plot that is being concocted in Jerusalem in order to kill Jesus. Let's start at John chapter 11, verse 45. Therefore, many of the Judeans who came to Mary and saw the things Jesus did, specifically raising Lazarus from the dead, believed in him. After all, Jesus shows that he has the power over life and death. He certainly is worthy of believing in him as the Messiah. But some of them went off to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees convened the Sanhedrin and said, "What are we going to do? For this man performs many miraculous signs." Now the chief priests are going to be members of the Sadducees. And then you have the Pharisees. They were two opposed groups that were in one organization. It's kind of like Congress. You have two warring camps. You have the Republicans and you have the Democrats. And quite often, including right now, there's a lot of war between them. In the same way, there was always war between the two houses of the Sanhedrin. The Sadducees, the chief priests, and the Pharisees. So they convened a court, the Sanhedrin, and said, "What are we going to do? For this man performs many miraculous signs. If we leave him alone like this, everyone will believe in him. Then the Romans will come and blot out both our place and our nation." Now, the place that they seem to be referring to is not the city of Jerusalem. Their place to which they refer, it should not be a capital P here, I believe, in the translation, is our position as rulers of the nation. They're saying, if everyone believes in Jesus, then the Romans are going to come and they're going to destroy everything, whereas right now, we really don't like the Romans, but at least they let us rule over our people. And so, at that juncture, one of them, Caiaphas, who is high priest that year, and as we observe, this is not length of term, but at that particular time in history, he was high priest, said to them, "You know nothing at all. Nor are you considering that it is to our advantage that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish." Now, he did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation and not only for the nation, but also in order to unite the scattered children of God. What he thought was it would be a wonderful idea for Jesus to die because then people won't believe in him and then the Romans won't feel threatened, and since they won't feel threatened, they won't take away our position and they won't come in here and destroy our nation. Did Caiaphas think that Jesus was worthy of belief? Absolutely not. He thought he was worthy of death. And this is the one before whom Jesus is going for an impartial hearing. Kind of looks like a kangaroo court. And although that kangaroo was drawn up in Australia, it kind of looks like a donkey to me. You know, justice is supposed to be blind. Notice the blindfold and the scales to balance truth from error, to come to the right decision, and then the sword in order to execute that judgment. And look at what she's standing on. She's standing on books of the law, but there's something between her feet and the books of the law. She's crushing a serpent. What we are supposed to see in the judicial system is represented by Lady Justice, not by the kangaroo court. And yet that's exactly what Jesus faced, a kangaroo court. Here we have a man who inadvertently spoke truth when he said it is to our advantage that one man die for the nation. Now notice where it says also, and that John says that God used this that he spoke. It wasn't intended to have the second meaning, but it did. And in verse 52, it says, not only for the nation, that is for Israel within the land, but also in order to unite the scattered children of God. Now let's think back. We have argued that this book, the Gospel of John, was written before the year 44, before Acts chapter 10. What is it that happened in Acts chapter 10? That's where we have Cornelius being the first non-proselyte Gentile to become part of the church by believing in Jesus Christ for everlasting life. As we look at a book that is written before that time, to whom is John referring when he talks about uniting the scattered children of God? He's talking about diaspora Jews. So it's not just here on behalf of the nation that is living within the land of Israel, but also for Israelites, for Jewish people, for descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob who are scattered elsewhere throughout the world. And the fact that this book is written early, it is written before Gentiles were incorporated into the church, makes it so there is no other way that this can be taken. But as we look at it, Caiaphas didn't believe Jesus to be worthy of belief, but to be worthy of death. So now as we turn back to John chapter 18, we have Jesus appearing in front of Annas. And then he's going to appear in front of Caiaphas. Do we really think he's going to get a fair trial between either one of them? So let me ask you a question. If Annas has ever since being deposed from the high priest position in the year 15, has been able to make arrangements that his five sons and his son-in-law serve as high priest, who's the real power? And so when Caiaphas said what he said about Jesus, he did not get rebuked by his father-in-law. I'm sure he was cheering him on. What do you think? But Jesus is appearing in front of a judge who has a son-in-law that has come out within the Sanhedrin stating very directly that he thought that Jesus should die. Well, now at this point, we're going to get a glimpse not of what's going on behind closed doors, but what's happening out in the open courtyard. In other words, right now we're looking at a place where John himself would not have been invited in, but John takes us to where he is. So in verses 15 through 18, we have John at the apparently the house of Annas. Some have argued that this is at the temple, but there are certain features that say that it is not at the temple, it would be at his house. And I think that that is correct. One of the details here with regard to it being at the house rather than at the temple, what was the gender of the gatekeeper? Female. Are we expecting to have female gatekeepers at the temple? Not so. We're not expecting that. This is a private house. So, in verse 15, as we're looking at Peter's first denial, Peter and John followed Jesus. John, who knew the high priest, entered the high priest's courtyard with Jesus. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was following Jesus, as was the other disciple. Now that disciple was an acquaintance of the high priest. So he went into the high priest's courtyard with Jesus. Now we notice that the other disciple is not named, but John never names himself in this book. And I think there is a fairly simple reason. It's analogous to the problem that we sometimes have around here. Sometimes people say, well, John said. Okay, is it John Nimla said that John the Apostle said that John the Baptist said? Well, which John are you talking about when you say John said? And that type of thing occasionally happens in conversations around here. It's sort of reminiscent of when I went to Bible camp this one year. There was my counselor's name was John. And counselors were able to put in requests for what type of people they would like to have in their cabin. And he said, I'd like to have everyone with first name John. There were a bunch of us named John. And he said, I just wanted to see what would happen when I said John, and everybody is looking at me as though I were talking to them. So anyway, John the Apostle does not ever name himself within this book. But there is evidence, and we have considered it at previous times in this passage, that he is very possibly someone who, although he is working in Galilee in partnership in a fish business, his father may well have been a wholesale seller of fish throughout Israel, may have had a rather large operation. And we have developed this in previous messages, so I won't go into further details here. That would explain how it is that John could be an acquaintance of the high priest, having run in higher circles. Let's see, I will mention one particular thing that I think sort of helps set the tone. You remember in the Synoptic Gospels where there is mention of the account where the mother of the sons of Zebedee asked for Jesus to put one of her sons, a very good boy, his right hand, and the other one at his left. And she said, you know, you can make your choice. You can decide who you want at the right and who you want at the left, but could you please promise me that you'll put one of them at one and one at the other? And Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking. Now, very interesting thing about this. Is this a question that we would expect from an impoverished woman? Or does this sound like a social climber? And besides that, when we look at the locale where the question was asked, it was down near Jerusalem or in Jerusalem. That doesn't seem real likely that she's going to be traveling all over the countryside with Jesus. Seems more likely that as a Jerusalemite, that she met with Jesus and his disciples when Jesus came down to Jerusalem on one occasion and posed this question. But when it says that he was an acquaintance of the high priest, it's giving indication that the family was fairly well-to-do and that he was in a position to gain admittance here into the house because of the degree of familiarity that he had with those of the household. So he wasn't stopped at the gate. He was allowed to continue on inward, and that is what he did. Peter didn't have any such credentials. And so in verse 15, we have him standing out by the gate. Verse 16. Peter remained outside the door until John convinced the girl who kept the door to let Peter in. So in verse 16, but Peter was standing outside by the door, so the other disciple, who was an acquaintance of the high priest, went out and spoke to the girl who kept the door and brought Peter in. Notice the degree of influence here that John has. He's not only able to gain admittance for himself, but he's able to get a stranger into the house at this time. So he's clearly familiar with the circumstance. They're familiar with him. He's able to make arrangements, and so Peter comes in. That makes this rather interesting. It does make it so that not only do we have a setting where Peter is kind of on dangerous ground, shall we say? I mean, here he has cut off the ear of the high priest's servant, and whose house is he in? Very interesting. Peter can get himself into hot water very easily. But he's now in a circumstance where there's reason for him to fear for his life. Reason for him to be quick with his tongue, quick to deny that he knows Jesus. Now, servant girl, in verse 17, asks a question of him. She asked Peter, you are one of his disciples, aren't you? And he denied it, while he, servants, and temple police were warming themselves by a charcoal fire. Now, she says, in verse 17, then the servant girl who kept the door said to Peter, you aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you? I am not, he said. Now the servants and the temple police had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing there warming themselves. Peter also was standing with them and warming himself. Now, the circumstance that we have here is she's saying, okay, I don't quite know how you fit. Everybody that's present, everyone that has come here to the household has come there for a particular reason. It isn't because the high priest's daughter is having a slumber party. You know, I mean, you start looking at why are people showing up here in the middle of the night? Well, it's because of Jesus. And then we've got this man with a Galilean accent. And, you know, it's how does he fit in? Peter's rather, he's standing out. He's rather obvious that he doesn't exactly fit in with everyone else that's there. He's not one of the servants. He's not a member of the family. He's not a temple guard. He's not an official. How does he fit in? So you must be someone connected with this guy that they just arrested, right? And Peter quickly thinks, I better not get myself associated with him. And furthermore, look at who it is that he's surrounded by. Servants, temple police, making a charcoal fire. Now, you know, he comes up close to the fire because it's cold. It's night. It's early April in Jerusalem, about a 3,000-foot elevation, probably in the low to mid-40s for the temperature, a little cool. So he comes there by the fire because if he's standing out in the corner, people are going to say, what's he hiding for? So courageous Peter comes on up to the fire. But then when he does that, who's he surrounded by? Temple police and servants. And wait a moment, it was one of those servants that he cut the ear off, and those temple police might want to arrest him, especially since he's right here surrounded by them. Peter has definitely gotten himself into a pickle because he let John talk him into, well, you know, let's go and I'll get you in the door. And there Peter is in the door wishing, I wish I had not come here. Well, meanwhile, some other things start happening. Because Jesus is not in the courtroom or in that courtyard here at this point. John would have been able to accompany Jesus up to that point, but he would not have been able to accompany him as he went to be tried in front of Annas. So John and Peter are out there in the courtyard near the fire, and John hears Peter putting his foot in his mouth. But meanwhile, Jesus is before Annas. So in verses 19 through 24, we have the actual appearance before Annas. In verse 19, the high priest, Annas, questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Then the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. And we look at this and we say, seems like a reasonable thing to do. It was against the law. This was not the procedure. The judge was not supposed to interact with the defendant. Because what was supposed to happen is there were supposed to be witnesses who were called, and the witnesses would be questioned. And as the witnesses presented what they had, it would be determined whether or not the defendant was guilty or whether he was innocent. But what do we have happening? Annas has already made up his mind that Jesus is guilty, just as his son-in-law, who said a few months earlier, it was expedient, it was to the advantage of them that one man die for the nation. Annas wants Jesus dead. He wants to find out anything that will show that he is guilty, and this is not proper, not legal procedure for him to start the questioning. Notice he questions Jesus directly. Now, one of the reasons for asking about his disciples would be to find out, okay, how big is your movement? How many people might we have to worry about? And so forth, in order to figure out how big an insurrection could possibly happen. Now, with this as a concern, isn't it interesting that Jesus was able to spare all of his disciples and none of them got arrested? Even motor-mouthed Peter, who's out there in the courtyard? Even guy who's quick with the dagger? His disciples are doing everything they can to get themselves arrested. And what is Jesus having to do? He's having to answer questions by someone who is clearly wanting to find out how big is this movement, how many people do we have to worry about? But he's also asking about his teaching. What's he looking for there? He's looking for a way to be able to indict Jesus. He's looking for a way to be able to try him, to have him put to death. Now, this is probably not a formal inquiry in the sense that Annas is not going to be the one who's going to carry the high priest's gavel. That's going to be before Caiaphas. But you might say that Annas is on a fishing expedition. He's looking for anything he can do in order to make it easier for them to put away Jesus and dispose of this problem that they have before them. Verse 20. Jesus said that he had spoken openly, that he does not have one agenda in public and another in private. In verse 20 it says, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple courts where the Judeans always congregate, and I have spoken nothing in secret. Now we need to make note of something here. All of the Gospels, all four accounts, have times when Jesus speaks privately to his disciples, do they not? John is not making a bald-faced contradiction to say Jesus never said anything in a private setting. What is going on here is he's saying Jesus is not someone who speaks out of both sides of his mouth. Jesus is one who has the same message when he's speaking publicly as when he's speaking privately. When we look at the accounts, whether it's John or any of the other accounts, what we find is that Jesus gives a little more explanation, but what he says in private is in keeping with what he says in public. No one would expect that Jesus would never say anything in a private setting. And clearly, if that were the way that the statement were meant, Annas would have been able to ask questions. You mean you have disciples and you never say anything to them in a private setting? You only talk what you say in public and so on and so forth. What Jesus is saying is, I only speak out of one side of my mouth. I am speaking the truth. He is not someone who misrepresents himself. Now, with that as a setup, then Jesus makes a follow-up statement in verse 21. In verse 21, Jesus challenged the propriety of the high priest questioning him. The high priest should question witnesses that have heard what he taught. So he says, why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I told them. Look, they know what I said. There was no expectation that Jesus should be put in a position to possibly incriminate himself. The high priest is supposed to be conducting things legally according to Jewish law, which meant that there would need to be a questioning of witnesses to find out if the witnesses' testimonies stood up. If you have two witnesses that disagree, what do? You start probing. What happens? Pretty soon, one person's caught in a contradiction and they're shown not to be credible. That person's testimony is tossed out, and you keep examining. You keep probing the witnesses in order to find out whose testimony stands. And if you have two or more witnesses whose testimony stands, then you have a serious piece of evidence that is regarded as proven. Now, this is why Jewish law at that time made it very explicit that nighttime trials were illegal. Why have a nighttime trial? Because all the witnesses are asleep. They didn't even know Jesus was arrested. So although we have hordes of people in town who could testify of what it is that Jesus taught, they're at home in bed. And now we're having a trial that is not being conducted through witnesses, but it is probing Jesus directly to see if he will contradict himself or if he will give some information that they would be able to find useful. You probably have often heard nighttime trials were illegal, but it usually isn't followed through. Why? We have to look at what is expected here in the courtroom situation. As we look in that context at verses 20 and 21, Jesus is not being snippy with the high priest, is he? You know, at first glance, it might seem that he is. Oh, well, you know, you ought to just ask other people. You shouldn't be asking me. Why don't you ask other people? Jesus is politely reminding him instead that his obligation is to work through witnesses. And Jesus says, I have given lots of information publicly. There are lots of witnesses, so you can conduct the trial in the way that is proper, but you need to have witnesses present, need to wait until daytime, need to start calling witnesses, need to start examining them. But instead, there is an effort to railroad Jesus. This is in keeping with someone who thought it was expedient for one man to die. The judge has already made up his mind. So in verse 22 through 23a, a temple guard struck Jesus and rebuked him for insubordination to the high priest. And when he had said these things, one of the temple police standing by slapped Jesus' face, saying, is that any way to answer the high priest? What Jesus was doing was reminding them of proper court procedures with an illegal trial that is being held at night without witnesses by a judge who has already made up his mind, who is directly questioning the defendant rather than going through the proper procedures. And I would have to say, Jesus very respectfully reminded the high priest of the proper way to conduct a trial. There was nothing insubordinate. Once we understand what Jesus is doing, we see there was no insubordination. Notice, Jesus did not apologize, did he? In verse 23b, Jesus challenged the propriety of striking him and explained the correct procedure. They need to determine whether evidence of evil doing actually exists. Jesus says, if I have spoken wrongly, give evidence about the wrong. But if rightly, why do you hit me? Jesus said there's a proper way to do this. You need to gather witnesses, have them testify. Then they are to be examined to find out whether their testimony stands. And if there are two witnesses whose testimony stands, careful examination, probing questions, then it is to be regarded as evidence that stands. And then handle it accordingly. But striking Jesus is an admission that they weren't going to play by the rules. That was not a procedure that should have been conducted on someone who is innocent until evidence comes forth that he is guilty. And then, rather than striking him, the law would be carried out if he had been found guilty. Well, apparently Annas gave up in due course and decided that he wasn't going to find out anything that he didn't already know. So he sent him on for the real trial in front of Caiaphas. So Annas sent him to Caiaphas the high priest. Verse 24, Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Well, meanwhile, Peter and John are still there in the courtyard. And it's still cold, probably a little colder. It's getting a little later at night, getting a little closer to that fire, getting a little closer to those temple guards and those slaves that are there of the high priest, and being set up for Jesus' prophecy to come true, that there are going to be two more denials. So verses 25 through 27, we have Peter's second and third denials. Verse 25, while standing by the fire, others also asked Peter if he were Jesus' disciple, but he denied it a second time. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, "You aren't one of his disciples too, are you?" Now when you think about it, when people are standing around a fire, they tend to face the fire, don't they? So there's plenty of light coming on there, and people are saying, "You know, his face looks familiar. After all, remember, the night there that this is the night before Passover. What happens on Passover? Why is it that Passover, how do they determine when Passover is going to be? Okay, sundown, but how do they know which day of the month? Full moon. So when Peter chopped the ear off of that servant, there they were with all of the lots and lots of soldiers holding torches and lanterns, and it's a full moon. They got a good look at Peter's face then, and here Peter is standing in front of a fire, and they've got a good view of his face. There is he standing in front of the fire, and probably there were torches and so forth around in order to make the courtyard of the high priest's home well lit up. So they're looking and they say, "You know, you looked familiar. Did I see you at the grocery store? Oh, no, it was over there at Gethsemane. I remember it was earlier. And you had a dagger, didn't you?" And so, you know, they're saying, "You know, you don't really fit in this group, and you certainly look familiar, and it wasn't the friendliest circumstances that I saw you last." Then he denied it and said, "I am not." Peter says, "I wish I hadn't come in this gate. I wish she hadn't locked it behind me. I wish I could be anywhere else." But here he is, and he's shrinking back. Notice he's doing exactly the opposite of what Jesus did. Jesus stood there and very firmly and very confidently was able to say, "You know, you're not handling the procedure here the way you ought to handle it. You're not examining me the way you should. Make sure to let my disciples go. They haven't done anything wrong." And going out to meet the guards as they came up to arrest him, speaking very boldly, saying, "Who is it that you seek?" And then he says, "I am." When they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus is very bold, and Peter, who normally is apparently bold, now the cat's got his tongue. And there's no boldness. So he denies it. He says, "I am not." So then in verse 26, well, one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, said, "Didn't I see you with him in the garden?" So a servant related to Malchus, whose ear Peter had cut off, asked Peter if he were the man he saw in the garden, but he denied it a third time. Peter's getting himself in deeper, and he's probably wondering, "How am I going to get myself out of this place?" And as a result of thinking about his life, is he really thinking about the Lord? No, he's not. So Peter denied it again, and immediately a rooster crowed. Jesus had predicted that before the rooster crowed that He would deny him three times. We spoke earlier on that prophecy that Jesus had made, and we've indicated there that in Mark that it says before the rooster crows twice, and we've talked about how people often make it very complicated and think that there are as many six denials and six cock crowings and get real complicated. But it's really simple. This rooster actually crowed two times. Once, twice. Before it crowed the second time, Peter had denied Jesus three times. And guess what? Those same three times that Peter had denied him were before it crowed the first time. So it crowed once, twice, and before that, Peter had denied the Lord three times. It's a simple reconciliation. But why is it that Jesus told Peter that? He wanted Peter to be able to say, hey, wait a moment. Jesus knew that this was going to happen. Jesus predicted it. Just like Jesus predicted Judas's betrayal, just like he predicted that the high priest would arrest him, he would be put to death, on the third day he would rise again, Jesus is predicting one thing right after another, and all these things are coming true. And as a result, the disciples, when they finally are able to sit back and look at it, say, Jesus knew exactly what was going to happen, and he was preparing us for it. And that is a major reason why they were prepared when, on Pentecost, the Holy Spirit was there to support them and to strengthen them in their new ministry. But when we look at it, Jesus' disciples were not ready for the task that was before them, but Jesus was. But part of Jesus' task went beyond just him going to the cross, dying, and being buried so that he could rise again on the third day. Jesus' task also involved getting his disciples ready for that day when they would carry the torch as he went to be with the Father. We tend to underestimate that. We tend not to see how important that was. It was of vital importance because there was no plan B. There was no relief team. There weren't any alternate jurors prepared to step in. These 11 are the ones who are going to have to carry the task. But guess what happened to all of them? They all died. Not before they left us with the New Testament. Not before they left us with the Gospel of John, not before they left us with that which would prepare us for the ministry in front of us. The question becomes, are we going to drop the ball? Are we going to be like Peter and when push comes to shove, oh, I don't know him. Let's see, I better hide that book because I don't want to talk to that person. Yeah, they might ask me a question. I don't know the answer. I better not have a living water that they can see. I better not hand them one because they might ask me something. We don't want to be like Peter. We want to be bold. That's what Jesus was preparing his disciples for. And Peter was soon prepared and carried out the task that was before him. We talked in our introduction about another man, and I'm not quite sure what happened to his picture at the beginning of the slide presentation. Private First Class Ross McGinnis, who gave his life back in 2006, he could have scrambled out of that turret and been safe, but his four comrades all would have died. And he there had the option to get out or to dive onto the grenade. That's what he chose to do. And when we look at the disciples, they were soon prepared to dive on the grenade as well. And Jesus is seeking to prepare us for ministry for him, regardless of the cost. Because you know, there's something that can't be taken away from us. Our life. Yes, we can lose our physical life, can't we? Yes, we can lose friends. But we cannot lose our everlasting life. We have something that's better than a money-back guarantee. And that's why we should stand boldly and proclaim the message of life. Shall we pray? Father, we do thank you for your word. We thank you for how you show the contrast between Jesus and disciples who were not yet ready. But at the same time, your word also shows us that those were men that you did prepare, and they were ready to stand up and to land on the grenade, so to speak. We pray that you would make us bold in our proclamation of the message of life. We thank you for the guarantee, for the promise that you make in passages like John 5:24. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life, shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death to life. We thank you that everyone who believes in you has one thing they can count on, your promise, everlasting life. And we thank you for this in Christ's name.